Hello, this is Robert Hosrey, the executive producer of 10 Lessons It Took Me 50 Years to Learn. The team at 10 Lessons would like to thank you for tuning in every week to hear our guests share their wisdom. It takes a lot of effort to publish and make this show every week. We're taking a two-week break to rest and recharge so that we can keep bringing you these fantastic guests and great lessons. We don't want you to go without your weekly dose of wisdom, so for the next 2 weeks we will be re-releasing two of your favourite episodes. This week it's Andre Alfonso, Collect Adventures, Not Things, with great lessons like don't eat your lunch on the way to work, banish psychic vampires, burn your masks and more. Definitely worth listening if you're new to 10 Lessons, or listening again if you've been with us for a while. If you want to know how you can help the show continue our work, here are a few things that you can do. If you aren't subscribed to the show, then please hit the subscribe button. If you are already subscribed, thank you. You can also leave a comment, a review about our show, but the best thing you can do is tell someone about 10 Lessons. Word of mouth is always the best way to help this show grow. So thank you for tuning in, and we'll be back in 2 weeks with a new episode. In the meantime, please enjoy Collect Adventures Not Things with Andre Alfonso and Duff Watkins.
Hello and welcome to the podcast 10 Lessons It Took Me 50 Years to Learn, where we dispense wisdom, not just information or mere fact, to an international audience of rising leaders. My name is Duff Watkins and I'm your host. This podcast is sponsored by the Professional Development Forum, which helps young professionals of any age accelerate their performance in the modern workplace. And today you'll hear honest, practical advice that you can't hear in a textbook, because it took us half a century to learn this stuff. Today's guest is Andre Alfonso. Andre, welcome to the show.
Hi, Duff. Really glad to be here.
Andre is the director of IRL Group Australia, and they help professionals improve their communication skills. But there's more to it than that. It's deeper than that. What they actually do is teach you, how to inspire and influence other people in order to create a more human workplace. Does that sum it up, Andre? Did I get that right?
Yep. I just hole in one, Duff. And I think the other thing which I really like talking about, because it's so integral to what we do, is the sorts of ways that we do it is by teaching business people the same skills that actors learn in acting school. Mm-hmm. And I think that kind of makes it really funky.
Mm-hmm. Andre is also co-author of this book, Strategic Connections. A lot of people I talk to are connected, but they think they're networked. There is a difference between networking and connection. If you want to learn how to connect strategically and make networks work for you, this is the book, Strategic Connections. Andre Alfonso is one of the co-authors. More about this later. Just wanted to make sure I got that in. Andre, let's begin. You've held a number of senior positions in large companies. Do you remember what your first business lesson was?
Yeah, look, you know, can I just tell you a quick story?
Sure.
It's mid-80s. I'm on my first business trip, and I'm in London, and I invite an ex-colleague of mine, not a client, an ex-colleague of mine who works in a competitive company out for dinner. And I said, I'm going to pay, you choose. So he was a really nice guy. And we went to this place in Covent Garden, which was a Michelin star restaurant. And we had an amazing dinner. And after dinner, which was quite expensive, he had this penchant for Armagnac, which is... and we see on the menu, there is a 1918 Armagnac. So this is like 70 years old, been bottled, right? So we sort of, in the spirit of the moment, say, we've got to try one. So we have a 1918 Armagnac. And then he goes, hey, that was really good. Let's see if we can do 10-year increments, what we think. And we went from 1918, 28, 38, 48, 58, 68, by which time we were kind of pretty smashed. The bill comes. It is £650, right? £650, which in those days was equivalent to about $1,600. In today's terms, it's about $3,000, right? now I had to figure out how I get this across on expenses, and I was sweating because I didn't have $1,500 lying around to spend. I was a manager, a middle manager in a company at that stage.
You're about to be a former manager. Is what I'm hearing.
Former manager. So how do I, you know, and so I was feeling this amazing stress, and I spoke to a couple of colleagues of mine, and they said, "Oh, look, you know, cover it up. Say you had, you know, four or five different meals at different places." And I thought, you know what? I actually started writing out the expense report with all these four or five different, and I thought, no, I'm going to just go and eyeball my boss and tell him what I did. So I owned it and told the truth. And I went and spoke to him, and he looked at me and he says, "Okay, give me some time to think about what I'm going to do over here." And I walked out of the office, went back to my office, and those days we had offices, and he gives me a call. And he goes, "Put the expense form in. It's through." And I said, "Wow." I said, "Thank you." And he goes, "It's about trust, Andre." He said, "The fact that you told me what you did and didn't try to cover it up is the thing that makes the difference here." And I think that relationship that we had ever since there was one, to this day, actually, of immense trust. So I think the first business lesson I learned was own your mistakes, you know, don't try and kind of cover it up and tell the damn truth as opposed to faking your expenses. That was the first one, I think. That was a pretty powerful. And to this day, it's still something I tell all of the people who work with me and for me.
Just making a mental note here, next lunch with Andre, he buys.
So, I'm a bit more prudent about where we go these days.
and you're fortunate you had a good boss, but you know what you're saying reminds me, speaking the truth, it really isn't that hard. I mean, initially when you think about it, but when you actually do it, it just isn't that difficult. It makes me wonder why people put it off so, make such a big deal about it. Okay, what about second question, what have you unlearned lately? And you know what I mean by that, you know, there's a lot of things that you absolutely positively held to be true then, but now today you're a bit wiser, a bit smarter, and maybe even recently you unlearned something that you thought was gospel truth.
Yeah, it is. You know, you sort of come into this world with all of these beliefs that you hold pretty dear to your heart. So I do a lot of exec coaching, and I've always had this view for I've been doing it for pretty close to 20 years now, that if we're doing it, we're going to meet in person, and we'll structure it in a way that, you know, that was it. So I basically didn't do any coaching which wasn't face-to-face. And then with COVID-19, everything stopped, and I was forced to switch to doing it virtually, you know, Zoom or whatever the thing was. And blow me down, I found that it was different, in some instances better, and as powerful an outcome at the end of it. So what happened is typically I would do, you know, we'd meet together once every 2 or 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. We'd have a 2-hour session. We'd go through all the stuff. Now with Zoom, people can ring me up and say, "Hey, I just got an issue tomorrow. Can we get on a Zoom call? 30 minutes and we're done." So we've moved from this very structured approach to this very organic, flexible approach. And I think it's much more powerful. And it's opened up the rest of the world to me, because before I would only operate in my little patch over here, right? And now I believe that with a little bit of skill and using the technology, I can do that. So that's something I've had to unlearn and smash that belief, which I've kind of held for a long, 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 long time. So, yeah.
That resonates with me. I also do a bit of management performance coaching, and the same thing. I mean, what I find, it actually liberates in some ways. I mean, I used to be like you. I was a devotee, face-to-face, got to be face-to-face, got to be one-on-one. No, it doesn't. That's what we learn. No, okay. No, thank you for that. Let's go to the 10 lessons it took you 50 years to learn. Lesson number one, don't eat your lunch on the way to work. I'm thinking, but what if I'm hungry?
Well, have breakfast is the answer to that, right? Okay. So what happens? And you know, if you have our lunch on the way to work, lunchtime comes and it's all gone. There's nothing there. And I use that as a line because the lesson really here is around health. So let me tell you a quick story, just about 60 seconds or so. 2015, and I'm in hospital, upside down, in emergency, and people are getting the defibrillators ready, and I'm in a state of panic, and I say to the nurse next to me, what's happened? What's going on? She said, Andre, you have just reached critical, and we are trying to save your life, right?
Defibrillator is, they put the pads on and say, clear, and they zap.
Boom, yeah. Okay. And in every movie I've seen, Duff, every movie I've seen, when they do that, the patient never comes back. They always eventually die. I don't know about you. So it's like defibrillators don't have in my experience, that doesn't have a great outcome. But I thought to myself, you know, here I am in my 50s. What the hell? Is this it? Am I going to die? And it's interesting when you kind of make eye contact with death, everything shifts. Everything shifts. So I guess since then I have been, because I was diagnosed with heart disease in my 40s, right? 42, I had my first heart attack. And I was messing around with it, you know, a bit of this, bit of that. Yeah, look, I'll watch my diet. I'll do a bit of a walk over here, but didn't really take anything seriously. In the last 5 years, I've been seriously trying to reverse my heart disease. And according to my cardiologist, my last visit, he thinks I'm pretty much there.
Mm-hmm.
But the point I'm trying to make in terms of don't eat your lunch on the way to work is when you're 20 something, even 30 something, you're bulletproof, right? Kind of invincible. I can put it off to a later date. And now I knew when I was in my 20s and 30s, both my parents had heart disease, that mm-hmm. it was something that was going to come knocking on my door.
Mm-hmm.
I'd wait till I was 50 before I sort of started to take it seriously. You know, 42, boom, hit me, almost died. And even after that first instance, I kind of kept putting it off, because one of the things is if you cash your chips in too early in life, later in life, when you actually need it, it's not there. And hence eating your lunch on the way to work. You know, you got to put some bit into the future. And this is really an investment in your health. And it's not just your physical health, it's your mental health as well. And I think as we are getting more and more aware of the sorts of stresses and pressures we have, growing up, I was, you know, I smoked, I ate really bad food, not much exercise, stress. God, stress was, you wore stress on your mm-hmm. arm like a badge of honor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, then, yeah.
Boom. You know, you're lying upside down in a bed and you go, what? What the hell?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so I think to any people who are out there listening to this who might be in their 20s, 30s or 40s, it's just to be cognizant of not cashing your chips in way too early.
You know, it rings a bell, because I used to run psychotherapy groups in psychiatric hospitals, and I'm hanging out with the psychiatrists, the young trainees, and I love those guys. But some of them were chain smoking, they were overweight, they had clearly unhealthy lifestyles. And I deduced that they thought health was the absence of illness, when in fact, health, as you say, is an investment, is a state that needs to be created and perpetuated, and I'd say protected and preserved. And I don't know why that's hard for some people to accept. There's a responsibility that we have to keep ourselves healthy. I mean, if not for you, although that's enough, you know, maybe for the ones that love you.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. No, critical. I think and what I've found, Duff, in the last 5 years is because I'm really focused on my health. I have this amazing energy right now, amazing energy. You know, my wife and myself are about to launch a new business, right? And people are saying to me, well, what the hell? You know, you should be taking it easy, Andre. And I'm going, I don't want to. So all of a sudden, it's like, if I had this kind of vitality, you know, boom, you know, 10, 15 years ago, what would have happened? Anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
You can't look back.
Well, what I'm hearing, it's never too late.
Yeah, it's never too late. Never too late.
Lesson number two, handcraft your personal solar system. Now, tell me more. I know what a solar system is, and I'd really like to be able to more godlike and create one. So tell me how to do that, Andre.
Okay, so if you think about a solar system, it's critical to our survival, right? It gives us heat, it gives us light, it gives us gravity. Without it, we probably wouldn't exist as a species. Well, if you take that metaphor and extend it in terms of the relationships we have in life, we actually have a solar system that kind of it's through happenstance that it forms. It's not strategically, and then it's the book Strategic Connections, right? Mm-hmm. And what the point I'm trying to make over here is take time to kind of handcraft the people you want to come into your lives. They say you have friends for a reason, friends for a season, and friends for life. And you know as well as I do, you come across, as we walk this planet, we come across people that we want to hold on to. There's something mm-hmm. about the chemistry that happens, and you go, you know what? That's someone I want to be in touch with for the rest of my life. So crafting your personal solar system is to make sure that you're strategic and intentional about the people that you want to be around and in your life. Mm-hmm. But there's a couple of things I would say to you in terms of making that happen. The first one is there's a tendency to surround yourself by cheerleaders. Mm-hmm. And cheerleaders mm-hmm. are great. They make you feel good. Yeah, but it could also be like a bit like the Hans Christian Andersen fable of the Emperor's New Clothes. Mm-hmm. You know, cheerleaders don't actually tell you stuff that might upset you. So I think as you go about crafting your personal solar system, you've got to have in it people that are going to bring out the very best in you. And one of those is what I call a personal critic. It's a term I only came across recently, and I love the idea of a personal critic. That means someone who is willing to tell you what they think and feel without any consequence. Mm-hmm. They do so because they come from a place of love, mm-hmm. right? And I do have a couple of those people in my life, and I always seek them out to say, well, what do you think about this idea? What do you think I should do over here? And I know that the advice I'm going to get back, it's going to be based on their truth. And it's not going to be, you know, sugar-coated in any way. And you know, you could often say, you know, that is often your spouse. And that is true. I think if you have that sort of relationship, I do with my wife. Mm-hmm. She tells me a lot of stuff I probably don't want to hear.
Yeah, I marry mine. Yes, true. Yes.
However, when you're involved in a romantic or an emotional relationship, there are dynamics over there which, you know, people kind of – they have to live with every day. So people mm-hmm. sometimes hold back in terms of what they want to say. But having a personal critic, which is someone outside of that, that's willing to tell you, I think is really important. As well as those people that are going to take you out of your comfort zone and inspire you to kind of do those sorts of things. So yeah, I think for me, you know, being strategic in the connections from the book, if you like, is part of it. But it is about your personal network as well as it's your life network as well as just your business and other things. But mm-hmm. it is that solar system that's going to make you bring out the very best in you as a human being.
Mm-hmm. And choosing it, consciously crafting it.
Absolutely. Again, investing in it, making sure that people are getting something back from you, from being connected with you. So mm-hmm. it's being really intentional. It's about, there's a generosity of spirit that exists in these special relationships, right? It just gives you energy, it gives you inspiration, and it gives you truth.
Generosity of spirit. Now, that's it, man. You know, to me, I think you nailed it there. Because it's not a chore. You know, it's not a drag to be around those people. Even if you know they're going to give it to you straight, it's okay. That's what separates them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Similar to that, point number three, banish psychic vampires. Now, I've been anti-vampires my whole life, Andre. I say, round them up, ship them back to Transylvania, or in the U.S., build a wall, whatever it takes. But the psychic vampires, tell me what you mean.
It's actually the other side of the coin to what I was talking about before. And the quick story. So I used to work with a guy about 15 years ago. And we used to run workshops. So I used to run a training company. And he often come back and go, oh, I said, how was the workshop, Garrett? And he goes, it was fantastic, except for a couple of psychic vampires in the room. And you know what I mean. So if those of you who've been in a classroom would know exactly what that is, it's those people that kind of suck the energy out. They're negative. They're, you know, they're mismatches. They don't want to be there. They're cynical. So, you know, those are the psychic vampires. And I've realized as, you know, as I've gone through life that I've kind of let a lot of them into my life. And I find that they used to suck the energy out of me.
In so many ways,
they suck. And again, this is probably one of the hardest things I've had to do, which is about making sure I limit or banish those relationships that, and it could be from clients, it could be from colleagues, it could be for people who work for you, it could be friends, and it could even be family members at some stage. Not immediate family, but usually extended family members, right? Mm-hmm. Where you just feel this energy, you know, they leave and you go, I just want to shoot myself. Mm-hmm. It's like, no. And life is too short. I don't want that in my life. I don't want people making me your personal solar system at one hand brings out the very best in you. Psychic vampires actually bring out the very worst in you. Mm-hmm. And I think banish them, get rid of them, move them out. You know, there's a guy I used to work with a long time ago, worked for me, and he was just one of those. You know, he'd show up late for meetings. If he was sitting there, he'd be looking at the newspaper in our sales meetings. He'd be mismatching everything. If you say blue, they would say gray. You know, everything was sinister. That's not going to work kind of approach. And it was just bringing everyone down. And eventually, he had to go. Mm-hmm. And I remember going to my boss at the time and saying, look, here's the situation. This is the guy. He's bringing the whole team down. And, you know, we're just not being able to hit our straps. And I remember what he said to me. He said, Andre, no breath is better than bad breath. Yeah. And I think that kind of, that phrase is stuck in my head for some reason for a long time. And I think that's it. Banish psychic vampires, get them out of your life.
Easier said than done sometimes, but then again, is it, now that I think about it? But the point is, it's important to get rid of those. Because you say, or you sent that they have a disproportionate influence on your life. I mean, their negativity sort of outweighs their presence in some ways.
Yeah, so one comment or one interaction can send you down a spiral for days, weeks, and months. Right? Days, weeks, and months. And, you know, it's just not worth it. It's not worth it, really.
All right, point number four, engineer a halftime pause.
Yeah, this is something I really practice and believe in, and when I coach people, really encourage them to do this as well. Again, a story, back in the mid-90s, I was running a workshop for one of the big banks, and we had the senior managers sitting in this workshop, about 30 people, and we thought, we'd be clever, and I was facilitating it. We would invite an executive to come and just do a bit of a fireside chat for us. So this was the BRW Executive of the Year or something like that in the 90s. And he came and sat, and we were having this fireside chat. He talked about stuff, and I asked him the question. I said, look, a bunch of young leaders sitting around over here. If there's one bit of advice you could give them, what would that be? And he leaned back in his chair, and he thought about it, and there was this silence that seemed to go for a little bit too long, but he was thinking, and he said, okay, here it is. It's going to sound stupid, but here it is. He said, every Wednesday at 2 o'clock to 3 o'clock, my calendar has been locked. Nobody can access it at all. The only thing that can access that time I have is a family, personal family crisis or a customer crisis. He says, because what I do in that 1 hour, he says, I shut the door, put my feet up, I go for a walk, and I spend the time reflecting on what I've done that week and what I need to do going forward in that week. And it struck me that, Covey came up with, use the Eisenhower matrix, as we're all familiar with, which is, in terms of looking at the things we spend our time on are being urgent and important.
So By the way, let me just show people, this is an Eisenhower matrix. You can find it online. There are many versions of it. The point is about finding what's important and what's not and classifying them. Do you delegate this? Do you delete this? Is it urgent? Is it not urgent? Many forms of that. Stephen Covey popularized it, but it's attributed to General Eisenhower, who led the World War II Allied forces and is a former president of the United States. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. Yes. It's a fantastic tool and one that keeps giving because I keep coming back to it. And the whole idea of the Eisenhower matrix is that, yes, the things that are urgent and important, we do it first. But then what we find is as we go through life, we then drop into what's urgent but not important, also known as someone else's agenda, mm-hmm. you know, someone else telling us to do that. And then, you know, we get this cycle of going into the not urgent, not important, where we spend time on, you know, Facebook or social media or surfing the net. And the thing that always, always gets ignored or put on the back is what we call quadrant two, which is the not urgent, but important. These are things like your health, relationships, you know, setting up some goals, the things that, you know, your own learning. Mm-hmm. These mm-hmm. are things that are not urgent, but really, really important and tend to get thrown out. So when I come back to the story of this executive, that was his way of doing a review of the Eisenhower matrix, to sit down and take that pause or engineer that pause so I can sit down and say, what, you know, how's my week gone? And I think we can extend that. And I do extend that to doing it on a daily basis. You know, the importance of what happens at lunchtime is it gives you a chance to reflect. So the idea here is to reflect on how I spent the first morning and what am I going to do in the afternoon? Mm-hmm. And that can happen in any period of time. You know, we look at a year and typically we do that exercise on New Year's Eve while we're all sitting around a barbecue or watching the fireworks and thinking about what we have to do in the next year. Too late. We should be doing that on the 30th of June and saying, well, what's the year been like so far? What have I done? And what do I need to focus on? What are the important, not urgent things that I need to do? And I think, Duff, if you look at life itself, and I have a really strong and fundamental belief in this, that when you get to your early 50s, you're only halfway through your adult life. It's halftime, right? And in any game, what happens at halftime? You go into the dressing rooms and the coach sits down and talks to you and says, well, how did we play the first half? How are we going to play the second half? What do we need to do? The game is always usually won in the second half, right? So the whole idea of making sure in this busy, busy, busy world that we have is to engineer a pause, a point to reflect. I think that really gives you just so much kind of vitality and perspective. And I think that's it. It's perspective, is to just stop and reflect.
I have arrived at this consciously or independently of what you're saying. And what you're saying resonates. Every morning I do a review of yesterday with pluses and minuses, an evaluation, and then talk about what I need to do, what disciplines do I need to emphasize today in order to progress what I want to do. And I find that it helps. And a lot of the minuses keep occurring, oddly enough. Basically, bad habits or stuff I just haven't mastered yet. And that's okay. That's okay, you know, because that's the way life is. But the idea of reflecting every day, I find, have been very helpful. And it helps other people as well. And there is a strong psychological basis for it about journaling, writing, being able to process things, because it literally helps a person. It helps you process information. It helps you advance, whatever, however you define that. It helps you advance in your life. Basically, it's just being conscious and being mindful of things.
Yeah, just quick. Before my dad, probably a few months before he died, we were out having a coffee, and I said, Dad, you know, if you could, in one of those throwaway lines, if you could kind of give me one bit of advice going forward, what would that be? What have you learned in life? And he said, look, buy me a coffee next week and I'll let you know. So he went away and thought about it and took the assignment pretty seriously. And he came back, and what he said to me is he said just really simply, spend more time reflecting where you are. It's the same thing. You know, that power of reflection on life, because he said, you can just go down this path and then it's too late. The more points you have along the way to reflect, the better you will be. And I've taken that on board, and I do it to this day, and it kind of translates into this lesson as well.
And your dad is an educated guy. I mean, he was an Indian, but he relocated the family to Australia. Now, that's a big deal. You know, that's a big deal. And I remember, I think you said you were the only brown boy in all the white boys' schools. And this is when Australia is not quite as enlightened as it is now, whatever level that may be. So there are some stories there. But that's coming from a guy who made a big move for himself and his family.
Huge move. You know, And I often think about that in terms of the gift that he gave us and the sacrifice kind of he had to make. But yeah, but it was his wisdom that he imparted along the way that I still kind of adore, yeah.
Lesson number five. This is probably one of the most psychologically validated points that you will see in print over and over again. Lesson number five, collect adventures, not things.
Yeah. Well, I think I've found in life that, you know, things are great. They make us feel good and give us a spike. Adventures kind of, the payoff of adventures lasts a lifetime. Right, a new car is great for a few weeks and a few months, but you know, ultimately, the learning and the experience we have from adventure is that. So my belief is that we should stop collecting things and start collecting adventures. Mm-hmm. Now, the only caveat I'd put to that is, you know, there are people out there who make their lives as being collectors, mm-hmm. and of course, that's different, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, yeah,
that's their passion, and that's mm-hmm. okay. But often we just get so caught up in just getting the latest and greatest phone or the latest and greatest car or whatever, you know, whatever the summer or winter collection is going to be in terms of clothing, that we actually lose sight of it. And I learned this because I was a collector. And I think what happens as we go through our lives, you know, we spend the first half of our lives collecting stuff, you know, cars, houses, mortgages, families, all sorts of things. And then you get to 50 and you go, that was all great. What next? Where's the significance? And I think the whole idea of an adventure, and I got to that place, right? I got to that place at 50. I sort of thought, I'm going to throw in this corporate life and I'm going to go and start up my own business. And I took my wife, Kathy, who's Australian, born in Australia, our kids, our two girls who were in primary school at the time. I've got four daughters and a son. Our two youngest girls who were in primary school. We relocated them to India to start up a new business. And it was a huge adventure, probably the adventure of a lifetime for all of us in many different ways. Mm-hmm. And we went there with a very clear outcome focus, which is, you know, we're going to make so much money. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. But on reflection, the real value that came out of it was none of that. It was the experiences that we had. It was the adventure that we had individually and collectively. And now when I sit down and think about goal setting, I talk about it as an adventure, right? And for example, I mentioned earlier that my wife and myself are going to start up a new business on, you know, wellness, on mindfulness and yoga. And, you know, yes, it'd be great if we can get a financial return on it. But our view is, hey, let's start another adventure together. And I think that changes your entire mindset as to success or failure, because if you look at it as an adventure, there's never a failure there, right? There's never a failure. Yes, you've got to strive. You've got to make the best of what you can do. But if you go into it with that mindset, you never fail, as opposed to being outcome focused. Here's the return. Here's the goal. Mm-hmm. Here's the milestone I've got to get. And then you wake up and go, I didn't achieve any of those. I'm a failure. No, not at all. I think every goal you should look at it should be changed into an adventure. And I believe that, and I do that now, and I find it gives me a lot more passion and vigor in terms of pursuing different things.
Well, here's an example we've already talked about. It's health. I tell people, if anyone asks me about, we're discussing diet or exercise protocols and things, and I say, it's an adventure. You know, you walk that path yourself, and you will discover for yourself. And don't forget to have fun on the journey, because it's an adventure. You're supposed to enjoy it. It's not slog through enemy-occupied territory at night by yourself. It's not supposed to be like that. As Robert Louis Stevenson said, better to travel expectantly than to arrive. Mm. And enjoying the process. The psychological reference that I made earlier is every study of happiness that I've read, every book talks about that happiness actually occurs within an experience, not by the accumulation of stuff. Mm. It isn't things which give you that joy, that happiness, that experience. You're talking about taking the family to India, or, you know, it could be a diet, could be any bloody thing. And that's the point.
And I think you're absolutely right. Absolutely right. And in fact, it doesn't have to be these big things, Duff, right? It could be little things. It could be going to the supermarket to pick up some stuff on an evening and say, you know, if you look at it, well, hey, what am I going to experience? What am I going to see? What might be some interesting things along the way? It actually changes your mindset. You smile a bit more. You talk a little bit longer to the shopkeeper and your experience becomes a whole lot better. So I think if you look at adventures, even at the micro levels on a daily basis, it shifts your thinking a little bit and makes you a little bit more open to the sorts of experiences rather than head down, straight in there, pick up what you need to do, speak to no one, get the hell out.
Mm-hmm.
So I think adventures, the whole idea of an adventure mindset, maybe that's what it is it just gives us a lot more in terms of how we show up in this world.
All right, lesson number six, dare to be curious, dare to be present.
Yeah, so that's a recent one. And again, a story. It was my daughter, Molly. She's 22. And we were having a conversation and she's having a rough time at work a little while ago, a few months ago. And, you know, and she was telling me about this. She's quite emotional about it. And of course, like a father, a businessman, coach, I was dishing out all this advice and wisdom. And, you know, she looked at me halfway through the conversation and she said, and I'm paraphrasing, this is probably not exactly what she said, but it was a bit, this how I received it was, "Dad, I don't enjoy talking to you anymore because I don't think you really try to understand." And it just knocked me senseless.
Yeah.
I thought, you know, hang on. You know, I'm a communicator. It's what I do for a living here. And my daughter's saying, I cannot communicate. And it struck me that I had just stopped being curious. You know, I stopped being curious and I stopped being present. And it reminded me of this guy called Jiddu Krishnamurti, he's got a quote which I've always followed kind of most of my life. And for some reason, I'd kind of dropped the ball on it. I'm just going to read it out. It's very, very good. So Krishnamurti, for those of you who don't know, is, you know, an Indian scholar, theologian, stuff like that. He's a very, very thought-provoking person.
Very well-renowned too.
Yes, yes. And he says this, "If we try to listen, we find it extraordinarily difficult because we are always projecting our opinions and ideas, our prejudices, our backgrounds, our inclinations, our impulses. When they dominate, we hardly listen at all to what is being said." Right? In that state, there is no value at all. One listens and therefore learns only in a state of attention, a state of silence, in which this whole background is in abeyance, is quiet, and then it seems to me it is possible to communicate. And, you know, when Molly was talking to me over there, I just realized that what I was doing was projecting my opinions, my ideas, my prejudices, my background, my impulses right on her. And I've consciously, from the, it's actually like a wake-up call, even in my coaching work I do right now, the whole focus is to be curious. And the metaphor I use, it's a bit like driving through a school zone, a 40-kilometer school zone. It seems unnaturally slow, mm-hmm. but that's kind of how it feels when you are curious. You put everything on hold and slow it right down and really say, well, what's going on? You know, what's happening? Why might this be happening? Rather than thinking through, well, here's a solution, this is what's going to happen. And that's the second thing, which is kind of being present in the moment. So when people are curious, you've also got to be present. So you dare to be curious because you're putting yourself out there just to be there and dare to be present. I think that is such a powerful way to be when you're with other people who might be in some position of distress or challenge.
Yes. And what you're saying, I can prove what you're saying, because in psychotherapy, all forms of psychotherapy is just that, Andre. You sit there and you bloody listen to the person and you listen actively, you're engaged and you interact, but not as much as in a normal conversation because you've got a certain function there and let the person express and you'll ask questions, clarify. Even if that's all you do, that will have a therapeutic effect. And that's been proven for a couple of centuries now. And that just points out how important is the need of Molly, you, me, every person you've ever met, every person you ever will meet, is that need to feel understood. feel, not just be, but to feel understood. Mm-hmm. Of course, you're a dad, by the way. I think you ought to cut yourself some slack if you go into dad mode. That's a bit different.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the prejudices we bring in here is I'm the father, I'm supposed to dish out advice. Well, yeah, sometimes you just got to listen. You're always going to get, so curiosity and judgment don't make good bedfellows. They just don't. And we are so quick to judge right now in this world of pace. You know, we're constantly trying to judge something very, very fast. That's the thing we've got to slow down. You're always going to get to judgment. You're always going to get to judgment, but slow down the process of running towards it by being curious. Mm.
The thing that strikes me is a person who is not curious is leaning towards rigidity. And if there's one thing that I know about from psychotherapy, my days in working in psychiatry, rigidity is the kiss of death. Once you become hardened, a hardening of the attitudes, as we say, you know, it's the clock is ticking for you because you're beginning to close down, and that ain't good. That ain't good.
As I go through life and living in the second half of my life right now, is this is about learning and newness and being aware, and it's such an amazing world, really, and that we live in. To be curious is a gift.
Mm. Yeah, don't shut it down too early is what I'm thinking. Mm. All right, lesson number 7. You'll have to explain this one to me. Let light enter through your wounds.
Yes, so this is around about the best insights and learning and growth we have comes through adversity. Yep. So it's actually based on a quote from Rumi, who is the Persian philosopher most people would have heard about. And I think he said, the wound is where the light enters you. That's his quote. The wound is where the light enters you. And I've always kind of been captured by that. And there was this lady called Edith Eger, who's just released a book. I'm not sure if you've heard about it. She's actually causing quite a splash out there. So she was, she's 90 now. So she was in Auschwitz. She was separated from her mother. You know, her mother disappeared and she and her sister kind of survived that whole Holocaust experience. And then the death march, which is brutal, that happened after Auschwitz, and she survived that, right? And they carried through her and stuff like that. And, you know, so you think about the adversity that she does. Now she's a psychotherapist and she's written this book called The Choice, Embrace the Possible. It's if you want to check her out, Edith Eger, E-G-E-R, on TED. She's got a few TED things and the book is brilliant. But this is what she says. Our painful experiences aren't a liability. They're a gift. They give us perspective and meaning, an opportunity to find our unique purpose and our strength. And Duff, you know, I often think about that because for me, 5 years ago, almost dying, totally changed my life in so many, many ways. And for me, it was a gift. It was not, why me? Why did this happen to me? It was like, okay, what next? What do I learn from this? And it took me a while to get to it. I'm not that evolved as a human being. There was a little bit of, you know, why me? Why is it happening to me kind of thing? But I think I moved on. And I think that is something that I do carry with me today and working with people and working with my friends, family, coaching clients. It's about embrace the adversity that you're in now and ask yourself, what are you learning? What are you learning from what you're going through right now? And if you cannot find the learning, you're not looking hard enough. Because when you find the learning, the adversity is a gift rather than a death sentence or a sentence, right? And so let light enter through your wounds is really trying to reframe the adversity that you have. And I think young leaders who are growing up and they've got all of us still have lots of adversity in front of us in so many different parts of our lives. It's not nice to be there. And if you can avoid it, absolutely. But when we are in it, extract as much as you can from it. And I guess that's the whole idea of what this lesson is. I really believe it. And I say to, you know, my kids, when they go through a rough time right now, is to kind of lean into it. It's okay. What are you learning from it? What is it teaching you? If it doesn't teach you anything, well, you're not looking hard enough.
The reframing is so important psychologically. What you're saying resonates with me. I've done a lot of outplacement consulting with people who've been fired, and sometimes they're just blown away. I mean, they're just devastated. And I tell them, I say, look, you know, it's not so bad. The company's paying you they're funding your job search, and you get to work with a pro like me who knows more about this than anybody on the planet. So, you know, and you still got a payout, so could be worse. And then they kind of jacks them up, you know, and they think, well, yeah, I mean, you're not on the street exactly, pal. So, you know, life goes on. So let's turn the page. And we do. And they do. But the key, I think, is to reframe these periods of adversity, acknowledging that they hurt, that you feel what you feel.
Absolutely. I think, yes, you do have to have that empathy that goes with it. And people have to work through the stages of the personal challenge of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross talked about denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. Yes, people do work through that. But extract what you can from it. It's okay. It's okay. In fact, there's this idea of a thing called, this guy who's just come out, he's got this concept called anti-fragile. And it's...
Taleb.
Taleb.
Nicholas Taleb.
Mm-hmm. And the whole idea of anti-fragile is about, it's beyond resilience, because everyone's talking about resilience right mm-hmm, now. And mm-hmm. resilience is this idea that, you know, you fall and you bounce back. Well, anti-fragile is about you bounce forward, not back. Because what happens is in the drop, you learn all these things that actually take you forward. And he uses the metaphor of, you know, we go and do weights at a gym, and that causes tension and stress on your bones, but it also makes your bones stronger. You know, it's that old quote, I guess, that old cliche of what doesn't, I don't know who said it, what doesn't kill you only makes you stronger. I think there's a lot of truth in that, actually.
Nietzsche. But all right. Lesson number 8, from cavemen to neuroscientists.
Okay, so this is a little bit cryptic. And it's about storytelling. And I think this is the skill of our times. And it's a skill for us to master. And I talk about it from caveman to storytelling. It's because if you've read, and most people would have heard of Sapiens, a book by Yuval Noah Harari. And he talks about how Homo sapiens, you know, dominated this earth. And basically, the Neanderthals, which were physically stronger and more imposing, faded away, and the Homo sapiens survived and thrived. And he says the reason that happens is this ability of Homo sapiens to organize in mass numbers. And the thing that makes them organize in mass numbers is storytelling. And if you think about that and you look through the history books, you know, if you look at religions, it's around a story. You look at politics, it's around a story. You look at organizations, it's around a story. You know, you say Apple, you go Steve Jobs, you know, Wozniak. You know, you say Microsoft, you go Bill Gates, you go Branson, you go Virgin. I mean, these are stories in terms of organizations and, of course, the politics and religions. So the ability to tell stories then becomes really, really, really important. So at the company that I run in Australia, Aerial, which is the one we were talking about at the start, which is about how do you take the skills actors learned into business. We've been focusing on storytelling for a long time. Duff, you know, I know there's stories and there's stories, right? There's some stories that, you know, when grandpa's telling you at the end of the evening meal, you go, oh,
time slows down.
Please, people start looking at their watches and go, get the kids, time to go, right? Yeah. And then there's other stories where people are just in the palm of your hand. So there's stories and there's stories, right? And the skill is to be able to have people in the palm of your hand by telling stories. Because if you're a communicator, if you're serious about being a communicator, get serious about being a great storyteller.
Yeah. Okay. What do you think of this? Here's the trouble that I have with storytelling. I mean, agreeing with you so far. The trouble with storytelling is that it's such a great vehicle for bullshit. And we see it online, we see it in the press every day. These lies, these deceit, these falsities are propagated. I see it in sports, particularly American sports. They're always looking for the storyline about this player or this team. There is no story. It's just, you know, they're just guys playing. And so the writer will create a story that has to make up some sort of human interest angle. And it's a conceit. It's a fantasy. Why? Clickbait. They want attention. And so to me, it's a you know, great work of modern fiction, perhaps, but it's not a legitimate story. And that irks the hell out of me. Mm-hmm. And I see businesses do it too. You know, they'll spin their story, which is just manufactured nonsense. Mm-hmm. Actually bullshit's the correct word. So now, now why does that work? Because the brain is a sense-making machine, and we all respond positively to stories, and we always will, because stories help us make sense of the world. But these stories get appropriated by the forces of marketing or commerce or capitalism or politics, whatever, and geez, they get destroyed in the process.
Yes, and you're absolutely right. There is this huge flow of attention gathering around stories. Absolutely right. And in our point of view, it's about being authentic and being real with the story. For example, when we run our workshops, we often say to people, let's put the marketing message aside. Let's stop worrying about the product. Tell me about the biggest challenge you faced growing up as a child. And, you know, people say, well, you know, my mum left, or, you know, I was sent away to a boarding school, or I was bullied. And, you know, so they tell a story about their challenge. And then you ask the question, well, how has that affected how you lead people or how you do business today? And you know what? There is always something over there. And that's where the inspiration comes from. So it's got to come from here, not here. Mm-hmm. You know, we talk about head and mind. There's so much cognitive bullshit, as you say, right now, clickbait, that is pushing people down these rabbit holes that they really don't want to go through, that we actually lose sight of the heart. And in my view, that the best stories come from here, not from here. Mm-hmm. Yeah? And Ariel, we don't talk about how to structure a story that much. We don't actually talk about this is the opening, this is the middle, this is the end. We just say, tell your story, but say it with passion, authenticity. We show you some techniques on how to share it with amazing impact. Keep it short, not like grandpa, right? And have people there, but it's got to come from here. If it's not from here, you kind of lost me at hello.
You know, a good example of that is, and we see it everywhere, movies. Movies, good movies, communicate truth. They don't communicate actual correct facts. Those are not important. That's one thing we don't need. Stories are about the truth, not about facticity necessarily. So a good story will communicate human truth. The Adam and Eve story communicates truth. Was there a serpent? Was there a garden? Not really important to the story. It's the truth that it conveys. Good movies do that as well. And I guess that's what you're saying. A person needs to communicate their truth, their essence.
Yeah. And even in a marketing sense, yes, it's about that. But even in trying to capture an audience, I mean, I look back to Steve Jobs' commencement speech at Stanford as being probably one of the most inspirational business talks speeches in my lifetime. And it's based on three stories. Story one, it's not about amazing Apple and how we did this. But story one is I dropped out of college. Story number two was I was fired by the company I helped create. And story number three is I've been diagnosed with a terrible disease, right? It's not about all of this marketing BS, although mm-hmm, there was a mm-hmm. bit of stuff around there for sure. But, you know, that to me is about capturing the hearts and minds of people through storytelling, which is a personal, it's about him. It's not about the company. And I think when we sit down and show up in this world, we've got to tell more stories about who we are, you know, as human beings. I think that's it. And that's the whole idea of from cavemen to neuroscience, because as you're right, Duff, in what you're saying, to kind of blow up that tagline, because neuroscientists are now proving that what cavemen, we knew at caveman days, is the truth. As you say, stories light up more parts of your brain mm-hmm. than just facts and data do. So how do we then, in this world of capturing attention, how do we capture the heart? not just the mind, the heart.
Well, Hollywood spends a lot of time trying to figure that out, and indeed we all do, because we're all desperately hungry for a good story. And by that I mean a true story, one that conveys truth. Lesson number 9, you're suggesting we use noise-canceling headphones to filter out the dirty noise.
Yep, just like these.
Just like these, yeah.
Just these, yeah. I love that as a metaphor, because it's what we were just talking about. It kind of rolls on from the conversation we've had, is about in this world where everybody's trying to capture your attention right now, we are in this battle of attention. You know, we have devices and technology which, you know, pervades our lives to such an extent that every moment that you're awake, someone is trying to grab your attention. And consequently, we allow a lot of stuff into our heads. We allow a lot of noise in, a lot of crap that comes with it, and kind of sometimes lose the essence of what we're doing over here. So part of putting on the noise-canceling headphones is to try and filter out some of the crap that is actually coming in over here and get to the essence of what we're doing. That's one part of it. But the more important thing, Duff, in terms of noise-canceling headphones is your self-talk, your self-narrative, your inner monologue, or whatever you want to call it. It's the conversation you're having with yourself. And in the same way as we allow a lot of crap to come in, a lot of the conversations we have with ourselves are pretty terrible. And I often talk about this amazing story that I came across years ago of a Native American grandfather and grandson going for a walk on the prairie. And as they're going for a walk, the grandson seems troubled. And the grandfather says, you know, son, in your mind, there are two wolves. There is a black wolf and a white wolf. And the grandson says, uh-huh, tell me about the black wolf. And he says, the black wolf brings negativity and anger and hatred and shame and all of those things that are negative. He goes, okay. And he says, what about the white wolf? And he says, the white wolf brings hope and support and help and optimism and all of the things that are going to push you towards life. And grandson says to the grandfather, well, grandfather, which one wins the fight? And the grandfather says, it's the one you feed. Yeah, it's the one you feed. And I think as I work with executives today, their self-talk and inner monologue is one of the things I've got to work with. And the good thing about it is you can change it once it's brought to your attention that it's happening and with a few skills. And really, that's kind of what we're talking about. So John Milton is another great quote. I love quotes. John Milton, the guy who wrote a thing called Paradise Lost, probably considered one of the best bits of literature ever written, actually says, the mind is its own place. It can make heaven of hell or hell of heaven. Yeah. And I love that quote because that talks so much about that black wolf and the white wolf in the inner monologue that we're going through. So noise canceling headphones are really a metaphor to get us to pay attention, to filter out the crap, right? And let the essence through.
The psychological lesson in there is learning to dispute that inner voice, because it's just a voice. It's not always correct just because it happens to be occurring inside you. You can dispute it and debate it. And I always say, argue with it. Don't start a civil war within yourself. Don't do that. But it's fair enough to dispute. Just because you tell yourself something doesn't necessarily make it true.
Not at all. Not at all.
You take it. I mean, it'd be. You make a suggestion to me. I might dispute it. I would hear it. I would take it seriously. I might do some research about it. I wouldn't automatically necessarily. If I disagree, I might ponder it, but I wouldn't necessarily imbibe it uncritically. And the same thing when I tell myself something stupid, which I do on a regular basis. You know, you can feel free to reject and accept your own advice.
Very much so. Very much so. So I think that's it, right? That's the power, because how you show up in this world is so much to do with your own narrative that's going on there.
Well, that's your point. You can change the internal monologue. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of evidence to that. A lot of people are surprised by that, but you can change it. In fact, yes, probably bloody well ought to. All right, our 10th final lesson. Burn your masks. Wait a minute, Andre. Are you one of the friends of coronavirus? Do you think we should all burn our masks? You don't take it seriously? Is that what you're talking about?
No.
Oh, okay, good.
Wear your coronavirus mask at all times. Absolutely, you should. Now, these are the masks that we put on to cover up our insecurities as we go through life, right? So you mentioned earlier, Duff, you know, my parents immigrated to Australia when I was 11 years old. And I was put into a fantastic school, but I was the only brown kid in a completely, you know, Anglo-Saxon school, so to speak. So, you know, I find it tough going. And, you know, the sort of the doggy dog world of the schoolyard, of a boys' school, of, you know, people about to get into teenage and testosterone coming on.
But you got picked on, surely. You got bullied, surely.
Hello. Yeah. Look at this face. Look at this face, right? Absolutely. And, you know, what happens is there's a couple of things that happen with that. One is your own sense of belief and worthiness in this world just goes down a lot. The second thing is that there's a shame associated with it. There's this, that I'm not, you know, that I feel shameful of who I am. So the way you deal with that is you put on masks, right? So I started putting on masks at a very young age, and I realized that I had to do a couple of things. One is I had to lose my Indian accent really quick. And to this day, you know, you're a psychotherapist. You can probably help me with this. I cannot do an Indian accent.
You sound pretty Aussie to me, man.
No, I can't. And you know, people laugh at me and say, come on, do an Indian accent. And then they laugh even more because I can't do it, because I kind of programmed it out of my head. And the other thing, which is to try and be cool rather than this dirty, different brown-skinned kid, was to play guitar, right? So I picked up an electric guitar, wasn't it, you know, and tried to be a rock star, rock god, if you like, because that was one way of putting on another mask to cover everything else up. So, you know, the accent went, the head wobble went, the guitar came on, and all these masks came on. And I kind of wore them most of my life. I remember as when I first got my first job after school, I fell madly in love with this girl called Sandy. She was blonde and beautiful, and I, you know, still had all of those bruises from school. Never had the guts to ask her out. And eventually I did ask her out, and she said yes. And I remember going to my friend at the time, a good mate of mine, and said, hey, guess what? I've got a date with Sandy on Saturday night. And he goes, Andre, you got to borrow Dad's Mercedes, because if you show up in a nice-looking car, she's going to marry you. Oh, yeah. And then, of course, you have these images.
That's a deep understanding of the feminine psyche.
Absolutely. And then, of course, I have these images of Sandy and myself living on this beautiful cave top, you know, it's not cave top, beautiful a cliff face, you know, running along the beach with beautiful kids behind us in a lovely house. All of these things happen. And I showed up in Gary's dad's, because his father was out of town, red Mercedes, to pick up this girl called Sandy. And, you know, I knocked on the door, and the father who was there, she was living with the dad, opened the door, and the first thing he said, is that your car? And I was like shocked, because I kind of expected him to be a little bit more, you know, interested in my car rather than judgmental. And I kind of didn't know what to say. But it's a really good example of the mask that I put on to cover up the fact that, you know, I wasn't worthy enough. And if I had a good car, it would make me so much more worthy. And all through my life, Duff, I've put masks on, right? So I got a career. I fell in love with my career. It was an amazing career that I had in you know, going up to the corporate ranks and organizations. And that was my career mask. It made me feel good. But halfway through that praise, my marriage failed. My first marriage failed miserably. And I realized that, you know, my marriage had become an inconvenient truth, because I'd allowed this mask of being this career corporate guy to take over my life, and so on and so forth. It wasn't until 5 years ago, when I was having, you know, upside down in the bed with the defibrillators ready to go, that I kind of realized, and that was when perspective comes back and hits you, was that I'm not ready to go yet, because I haven't lived my truth. I've got to rip these bloody masks off and be who I am. And my wife, Kathy, today says to me, geez, Andre, you know, you've changed so much since that heart attack. And to some degree, that is the case, because I think I'm walking this planet without those masks anymore, and being true to myself and being true to others in the relationships, not trying to be the people pleaser and the yes man that says yes to everything, but actually speaks the truth. So I think the best thing I can to any people who are coming up in this world is to be conscious of the mask you wear and ask yourself this question: who are you trying to please today? And that's not that, if you want to please a customer, that's okay. But you know, who's are you trying to please today, and are they worthy of that honor? Because sometimes we actually go out of our way trying to please people who are not worthy of that honor. And we're living in the world of expectations of others. And I was for many times, you know, I can't do the Indian accent. You know, I had to play guitar. You know, I've had to fall in love with the career because it gave me stuff that dealt with my insecurities from a child. And I think it held me back. And now it's gone. And I've burnt those masks. And look, there's still some remnants of that still there. I can't say I'm a clean skin completely. There's still masks that I put on from time to time. But now I'm conscious of the ones that I wear. So yeah, I think so for anyone growing up is get in touch with your authenticity. And the best way to do that, as you probably know, Duff, is to just understand your values. You know, you ever do these values clarifications exercises and stuff. But, you know, what are those values that you live by and live true to them? Because I think that's where fulfillment kind of comes from.
What I'm hearing is when you burn those masks, it means you realize that, well, you have those masks because you fear that you're not enough, just not enough. And then at a point you realize that you are enough and you burn those masks. And the truth is you are always enough. You just didn't know it, or you didn't want to believe it, or
that's the psychotherapist in you, Duff. Coming I'm feeling better already, mate.
And it's the truth. You always were enough. You didn't, you know, you came complete.
Yeah.
But it's good lesson to learn. Maybe it's hard for some of us.
Yep, very much so.
Well, we will finish there on that note, Andre. I want to thank you for joining with us, and I want to remind the listeners that you've been listening to the international podcast, 10 Lessons It Took Us 50 Years to Learn. This episode is produced by Robert Hosrey and is sponsored by Professional Development Forum. PDF provides webinars, social media discussions, podcast parties, anything you want, everything you need. You can find out more about them at professionaldevelopmentforum.org. And it's all free, by the way. And by the way, please contact us. Email us podcast@10lessonslearned.com. And if you're interested in Andre's book, which he co-authored, Strategic Connections, send me an email. I will find a way to get it to you, get a copy to you. And if you have any comments, we'd love to hear from that as well. So thank you for listening. Thanks for joining us. And we'll see you the next episode of 10 Lessons It Took Us 50 Years to Learn.